KBOO Community Radio is proud to present The Yes Men Are Revolting as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Yes Men Are Revolting is a documentary directed by Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno, which follows the comedy troupe The Yes Men as they stage phony press releases and events to bring attention to environmental dangers and corporate greed. Again, that's The Yes Men Are Revolting, Thursday, August 13th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is streaming, podcasting, and archived at madnessradio.net. Welcome to our new broadcast station, KBOO, in Portland, Oregon. Thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, our guest is Kathy Penny. Kathy is a retired psychiatric nurse. She was diagnosed with catatonic schizophrenia and spent 3 years in a psychiatric hospital. She has since recovered without medication using psychotherapy. And she's the subject of the book by her doctor, psychiatrist Daniel Dorman, called Dante's Cure. She was also interviewed in the film by therapist Daniel Mackler, Take These Broken Wings. Kathy is also the founder of Desert Gathering, which is a unique holistic healing friendship community in Southern California. Thanks a lot for joining us today on Madness Radio, Kathy Penny.
Thank you, Will. It's great to be on your show.
So you've had a really incredible journey from someone who was a psychiatric patient in really extreme distress and, you know, kind of considered one of the chronic sort of lost cause cases of catatonic schizophrenia. And now you have become a psychiatric nurse. You're now retired and you have become a community organizer and a healer, and it's just really amazing to have you and hear your story. Why don't you get started by telling us a little bit about, you know, your childhood, and then what was sort of the formative experience that you came from when you started to have your extreme states and then ended up in a psychiatric hospital?
Well, I was the oldest of five. My mom was a widow, and I was 10 months old at the time when my biological father was killed in the Korean War. And at the same time, my mom was pregnant with my sister, Cindy. And so as a little girl, even younger than five, I could remember my mom going through depression. And when you're a child, you don't understand all the circumstances of things. So I thought it had to do with me, that I was the reason.
She would get really sad and withdrawn and not communicate.
Yeah, withdrawn and sad. And after my sister Cindy was born, both sets of grandparents would take turns taking us to their home to stay for days. You know, when my mom was so depressed, she wanted to be alone. And so when that happened, there's always this thought, you know, are we going to see our mom again, or does she like us? Those kind of thoughts. I could remember feeling that, always having a sense of fear regarding being left. When they would bring Cindy and I back home to my mom, she would be out of the depression, or she wouldn't be as depressed. And when she was not depressed, she was a loving, even when she was depressed, she was loving, but she didn't really express it. So when we came back home and she was not depressed or as depressed, she was more able to be demonstrative about, you know, showing the love and everything and doing things with us and being there, being present for us.
When did things start to get difficult for you in terms of having problems with emotional distress or extreme states?
Where it really started was when my mom remarried to another Marine, my stepdad. And at the time, it was not that noticeable that he drank a lot. But I'd say 3 or 4 years into the marriage, it became really apparent that he had a drinking problem. But this was back in the 50s, and he was a officer in the Marine Corps, and it was like it was something that was kept silent. And it affected how he related to us, Cindy and I, as his children, his stepchildren. My mom did have 3 more children with him, and so there was always this feeling with me. I worried about my younger sisters, my younger siblings, because when my dad would get home from work around 4 o'clock, he would immediately start in on the rum and coke and stay with it up until around 9 at night. But during that time, he would be very verbally and emotionally abusive, just really to my mom, to us kids. And it was hard to be in that environment. And I was sensitive to begin with. I already was super sensitive.
What kinds of things was he verbally abusive about?
Well, what I remember the most is affecting me was when I was about 12 or 13, and you know, that's when you are going through your change from childhood, adolescence to teen years. So I was starting to develop. And he would call me Fatty Kathy or whore, or, you know, if I tried to put on a little makeup or I tried, you know how girls are, dress a certain way, it was like he would always comment in a derogatory manner. And it made me very self-conscious and made me feel very, very bad about myself. And the other issue, too, was when my parents argued, he would go right up to my mom with his fist, and I was always worried about the threat of him physically hitting my mom. And that was a fear, too. Now, when my father was not drinking, which there were times when he did not drink, he didn't show those behaviors, and he didn't even remember those instances, you know, that he was behaving in that manner. But it just put a constant sense of unease and worry. I remember always feeling not centered, always sense of unease.
So the world that you were in as a child was, in a sense, really dangerous and scary and threatening and harmful to you and unpredictable and chaotic.
Yes. And being a shy person to begin with, when I would go to school, I would project this image of this real introverted, shy girl, and I ended up becoming the butt of jokes a lot because I was different, or I looked different, or I acted different. And that just made it even worse. That just added to what was already the trauma I was already feeling, the emotional trauma I was already experiencing. So I felt I had no place really at home, nor with my own peers. It was at that point I tended to go or dwell more on religion, like I was raised Catholic. So I started to dwell more on, you know, the lives of the saints and trying to relate to people who suffered for a good cause. But that didn't really, really help. As coping mechanisms broke down, like kind of like a domino effect, the psyche seeks out what it can to survive. And I ended up creating my own inner world to deal with the pain that was going on the outside world. And what I created, and it was on a subconscious level, I wasn't consciously aware I was doing it, but what I had created ended up putting me in a worse hell than the hell I was running away from or trying to get away from.
What kind of inner world was it? Was it a very religious world where you're communicating with the saints, or what was that world like?
Well, it began with saying my rosary on stone in the backyard, thinking that if I suffered my knees bled, God would see that and love me, and I, you know, someone would love me. But as that went on, that didn't kill the mental, emotional pain. That wasn't working. And when this horrendous depression set in, that it was like I had the weight of a mountain on my shoulders. I couldn't hold my head up, and the pain, when that began, I began to lose faith that there was a God, because I couldn't understand how God could allow one of his children to suffer so much. And then as it got worse and worse, I started to isolate more, I started to withdraw more, and as that was happening, I began to hear voices. And that experience totally threw me off. It was like, oh my God, it must be the devil talking to me. It was so alien to me, I couldn't understand it. But at the same time, a part of me thought it was because I was a bad person or not a good person that this was happening. But the experience of hearing voices and the severe heaviness and somatic pain that I was going through was worse than any physical pain I can ever think of.
What were the voices like that you heard?
Well, the voices that I began to hear were telling me to kill myself, to kill my mother, and to kill my little sister. And that was what was terrifying about it. It was terrifying enough to hear the voices, but to hear that, it was like, where in the heck is this coming from? This can't be coming from me.
And did they felt like they were coming from outside of you?
Absolutely. My experience of them were as if somebody had their mouth to my ear and was shouting loud whispers. It was as somebody had their face to my ear and was just shouting loud whispers. Had the effect of kind of like being around a beehive where there's all this buzzing, and then the voices, which I heard as loud whispers.
Makes me think of some of my own voice hearing experiences, which are also similar to like that, and they also can have, not all of them, but they can have that really aggressive, loud, angry quality to them. It sounds like you were, as a child, you weren't yourself fighting back or getting angry, or, and then maybe the voices sort of had that part of you caught up in them. Is that an interesting way of looking at it, or maybe trying to understand it a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. Because for me growing up, it really wasn't okay to have feelings, especially to express feelings of anger. You know, I was always the good little girl, you know, the good Catholic little girl that, you know, went to Mass every Sunday and was the neighborhood babysitter when I was old enough. So, you know, it wasn't okay for me to get angry. And then later on, as I became 13, 14 and started showing interest in, you know, girl things, it wasn't okay for me to do that either. So all those natural feelings and were repressed. And when you repress your feelings like that, they just don't go out into thin air.
When did you first see a doctor? When did you start getting involved in mental health care and eventually end up in a hospital?
I believe I was 17 and a half, and I had gone on this diet and had gone down from 128 to about 110 in 3 weeks.
And that was part of the sort of religious focus of sort of punishing yourself or trying to get some kind of penance for what was going on?
That was part of it. But another big part of it was it gave me some control over what I felt I wasn't able to control. When I was able to get on the scale and see that I had, through my own means, had lost 5-10 pounds, nobody else did it, I did it. It gave me a sense of importance. It made me feel a little good about myself. Plus, it made me feel that I had some control over something in my life when everything else was so chaotic.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio. You're listening to an interview with Kathy Penny. Kathy is a retired psychiatric nurse who was also diagnosed with catatonic schizophrenia and was hospitalized for 3 years. She has since recovered without medication using psychotherapy, and she is also a founder of Desert Gathering, which is a holistic healing friendship community in Southern California. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I imagine that's when your parents got concerned about you. That's when they called the doctor, or that's when they took some action?
Yes. My mom started taking me to this group therapy locally where I lived. And it was through a psychiatric social worker who was a co-facilitator of the group therapy. She saw the severity of what I was going through. And she suggested to my mom that I be hospitalized. And so my first hospitalization, I was put in a medical unit, given all kinds of medical tests. I believe they were looking to see if it was organic, which was causing my extreme withdrawal and other behaviors. And when that turned out not to be the case, the very next thing was it has to be psychiatric. So while I was in the medical unit, after all those tests, I was seen by a neurologist who referred me to a psychiatrist. And that's my first experience of being hospitalized for a psychiatric condition. And I was hospitalized for 2 weeks. And that's when I was started on the stelazine and the thorazine.
What kind of effects did those medications have on you?
Well, I was finishing my senior year, so it caused me to feel sedated all the time. It also it blunted my affect. I mean, it was like I felt I was in some kind of limbo land. Yeah, it decreased the voices somewhat, but I always knew they were there. And then after a while, the voices would get louder, so they never really truly took away the voices. And also what happened to me was I began experiencing dystonic reactions and akathisia being, you know, internal restlessness. I was unable to sit down or stay in one spot. There's always this feeling of urgency, and the dystonic reactions were actually the worst because I had this stiffness in my jaw and my neck, and I kept doing jerking movements that I felt I had no control over.
And these were side effects of the medication?
These were side effects of the medication, yes. And so here I was on medication that was supposed to help me. It made me even more isolative because I didn't want to go outside and have people see me walking around with my head jerking and all those symptoms of adverse effects.
And then at some point you ended up back in the hospital for 3 years, is that right?
I had one more hospitalization for 14 days about, I'd say, 8 months after that first hospitalization. And after that, I was on my way to Irvine Park with my intention of driving off the cliff there, because I was tired of the fight, of dealing with it. And instead, at the last minute, I drove to the psychiatric social worker's home. And she was with me for that evening and called my mom. And she was the one that got me the interview at UCLA's Neuropsychiatric Institute. And that's where I was hospitalized from November of 1969 to January of 1973.
And so when you went into the hospital, I imagine that must have been really scary for you. And did you just continue to withdraw and get worse? Because eventually they gave you a diagnosis of catatonic schizophrenia.
Oh, yeah. So by that time, I was totally withdrawn. What I had done was that the voices to kill, my way of dealing with that was to create my own voices in my head to counteract those. And they would focus on food, which I never ate, I would keep focusing on food. And to do that, I had to get rid of all external stimuli. Any stimuli that broke its way would disrupt my attention at getting away from the killing voices. And so I was totally, totally in a shutdown mode, just focusing on those thoughts to create voices, so I did not have to hear the voices to kill.
So you would just sit alone doing nothing?
Rocking back and forth.
All day for hours and hours?
All day, yeah. So that was my state of being when I was admitted to UCLA.
Now tell us a little bit about Dr. Daniel Dorman, who embarked on 3 years of regular intensive psychotherapy with you and was able to help guide you out of this state that you're in. And the book that he wrote is called Dante's Cure, the idea being, I guess, that if you want to get out of hell, you've got to go all the way through it.
Not only go through the experience, but have a guide, not just to go through, because you need someone there who could be your guide, who can support you. And Dr. Dorman, he came from a place where he believed in the restorative power of the human person. And no doubt in his life he had experienced things, although never to that degree, that he was helped with. And so he had a true calling to really approach the person behind the symptom and to help the person. I remember him saying to me, and this was towards the end of my hospitalization, when I asked him, why did you stick with me for so long? And he said, because everybody has a healing part in them, no matter how small. And that's what I approached in you. And I knew that by doing so, it would work out.
So what was it like being his client in psychotherapy? Because you were completely withdrawn and not even communicating. And you saw him several times a week?
I saw him 5 days a week, and sometimes 6 days a week if I was going through any kind of crisis. The several times that I attempted suicide happened on a weekend, he would come in and process that event with me. But our meetings were every morning, 8:30 to 9:30. He'd stay the full 55 minutes, and at the beginning, all I would do is just sit there and walk back and forth, because I was suspicious of anybody, you know, nobody had helped before, and so I was suspicious of any outside help. However, just by him being there and being present, that caused a little seed to develop. You know, it made me curious a little bit. And then into our therapy sessions, about, I'd say, the fourth month, he made a comment about, it must be very safe where I'm at, referring to the, you know, the rocking back and forth and the silence. The world can be a pretty scary place. And that's what I remember as really being the trigger that caused me to start paying attention, that, you know, what does he know about this? And maybe he's not like the rest of them, because he never focused on pathology. He never made me feel I had a diseased brain.
He was never trying to do patient education with you to get you to realize that you're schizophrenic or something like that.
Absolutely not. That was never, never the case.
So for 4 months, he sat with you, but basically in silence, and you didn't respond. You were just in your own world. And then he commented about how the world must be a really scary place to be feeling like you need to be in a safe place inside yourself. And then something about that really, really reached you. He really spoke to what you were going through. And then from that moment, is that when it slowly, gradually started to become opening up towards him?
That's when the opening up slowly and gradually started, yes. And again, a lot of the changes that occurred internally did not manifest outwardly till, I'd say, the last 3 or 4 months I was hospitalized. So even though externally I wasn't showing any improvement, things were percolating, and Dr. Dorman just never gave up. However, other folks came and went, and were ended up back in or sent to boarding cares or to state hospitals on medication because they did not see the, they judged the person by their external appearance and the symptoms rather than what was taking place inside. And Dr. Dorman didn't do that. He knew it was going to take a long time. In fact, there came a point in our therapy where I started hearing voices to kill him.
To kill Dr. Dorman?
Yes. Uh-huh. And so at that point, I'd say that was 2 years into it, I actually appeared to be getting worse. And there was talk about sending me to Camarillo or I'm too chronic a case.
So they were ready to, they were really ready to kind of abandon you to long-term warehousing in the system, just put her on medication, just let her sit there, and that's it.
Absolutely.
And then what was Dr. Dorman's attitude when you started to get worse, when you were hearing these voices telling you to kill him?
Later, after I got out of the hospital, when we talked about that, what he told me was, I knew that before you're going to get well, it'll get worse.
So he really held a hope for your recovery when you had really given up on it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. He never lost faith in me.
Kathy, we are just about out of time. Give us the contact information about Desert Gathering. People want to find out more about it and how they can get in touch with you.
Our website is www.desertgathering.com.
Kathy Penny, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you, Will. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to an interview with Kathy Penny. She's a retired psychiatric nurse who was also diagnosed with catatonic schizophrenia. She spent 3 years in a psychiatric hospital and recovered without medications using psychotherapy. She is a co-founder of Desert Gathering, which is a holistic healing friendship community in Southern California. Kathy's story is the subject of the book by her psychiatrist, Dr. Daniel Dorman, called Dante's Cure. And she's also interviewed in the film by Daniel Mackler, Take These Broken Wings. Portland Hearing Voices is an education and support community for people diagnosed with bipolar, schizophrenia, psychosis, and any extreme state of consciousness. We offer regular support groups, public events, resource referrals, and holistic mental health education. Embrace mental diversity and see madness in a new way. Check out portlandhearingvoices.net. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio is co-sponsored by peer-run support communities, Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Hosted by Will Hall, music producer is John Rice, with technical assistance from Jeremy Lanceman. Listen to our internet stream, podcasts, and show archives at madnessradio.net. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network, including KBOO in Oregon, WXOJ and WBCR in Massachusetts, Alaska's KWMD, and WPRR in Michigan. If you have an idea for a story or guest on Madness Radio, to help get us broadcast on a station near you, or if you just want to share what's in your head, contact radio@madnessradio.net.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
And now the KBOO News at noon for August 3, 2015. A forest fire in southern Oregon has grown to more than 23 square miles over the weekend and is only 3% contained. The Stouts Creek Fire is located in Douglas County, 25 miles south of Roseburg. The fire was first reported last Thursday. 35 families have already been evacuated, and another 100 were notified to begin preparations to leave. The cause of the fire is under investigation. In national news, deaths attributed to police actions jumped last month to 118, making July the deadliest month of the year so far. The increase broke a three-month trend of decreasing police-caused deaths. Of the 118 people killed in July, at least 20 were unarmed. 106 were shot, two died from being tasered, and two were run over by police vehicles. At least eight died while in police custody. In international news, trade justice activists are celebrating after trade talks for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, broke down on Friday. The talks ended on Friday in Maui, but representatives from the various countries vowed to continue with negotiations later this month, stating significant progress had been made. Earlier this year, the Obama administration won fast-track approval from the U.S. Congress, which allows him to push through a trade agreement in Congress with little debate. Under fast-track rules, Congress must vote on the negotiated trade deal within 4 months of the completion of negotiations. If an agreement is not reached this month, the final fast-track vote would occur during the U.S. presidential primary election season, complicating its passage. The Obama administration has approved the use of defensive airstrikes against the Syrian government. The plan calls for U.S. airstrikes if Syrian troops are found to be attacking the so-called moderate rebels that are backed by the U.S. The U.S. program to develop a moderate